Namaste and in La Ketch, and welcome to this episode of One World in a New World. I'm your host, Zen Benefiel, and as always, I'm going to give you the quick version this time. Namaste comes from the Sanskrit, spoken as Brahmi. It means the divine in me recognizes the divine in you. In La Ketch comes from the Mayan. It means I am another you. So consider those things when you meet and greet people on the street every moment and how that might affect your life. Don't believe me. Test it. You'll find out. All right, thanks. So this week's guest is Julie Kratz. She's from my homeland. I was born in Indianapolis, and that's where she's at now. She is the chief encouragement, or Scott, that too, chief engagement officer with Next Pivot Point that focuses on diversity, equity, and inclusion. She was a past inclusive leader for Adiana as a business development partner. She's got an MBA from Indiana University, Keller School of Business in marketing. She also has a Bachelor of Science degree from The Ohio State University in marketing logistics. And she's got a bunch of books she's written too. Among those are Little Allies, Allyship in Action, Lead Like an Ally, One, and Pivot Point. So Julie is a highly acclaimed inclusive leadership trainer who led teams and produced results in corporate America for nearly two decades before launching on her own. Let's welcome her. Thanks, Julie.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, this is going to be fun. So let's just jump right in. You know, I know coming from the Midwest, there's a whole different set of values, morals, and ethics that are kind of intrinsic to that. And in my opinion, they lead to this inner awareness and activity that many have. When did you first start noticing that there was this something inside of you that let you know that there was more to life than just the outer engagements that you saw most making?
Yeah, I was 8 years old. Kidding, but not kidding. It was, growing up in the Midwest, and I think we get kind of this stereotype of being, you know, traditional values, which to some degree is definitely, you know, there's definitely truth in that. But I grew up in Columbus, Ohio, which is a bit more, progressive, open-minded, because the university is
industry-driven, so. Maybe as well.
Yeah. Just open. Yeah. I would say, yeah. Very open-minded community because, you know, living in a university town, you don't realize it at the time because it just what you perceive as normal or what you see around you, but a lot of open-minded thinking, but there's also problematic thinking. And I remember I was 8 years old and a kid, and my babysitter was sharing a riddle. And if you probably remember this riddle about a kid getting hurt, going to the hospital, and their surgeon, you know, was their parent. But it made you, all the details I'm losing right now, but it basically made you think like, how could a surgeon be a woman? And I remember being appalled that someone thought that that was funny or someone that thought that that was okay. And here I am 8 years old, like, that's not okay. Right. I don't think that's all right. Like, why would you think that that's funny or a fun joke or riddle to tell somebody? So that's when the fire started, or at least my first recollection of that. But I was raised by a single mom. And so, you know, she was very much a proponent of women can do anything. Women are strong. So I saw dual gender roles being modeled by her in my household. Not that I wasn't exposed to stereotypes in a broader culture that maybe wasn't as inclusive. But she helped me see really from a young age, you know, Julie, your job is to help people. Your job is to help women in particular.
Yeah, your job's to confront the patriarchy.
Yeah. And I'm like, Mom, no one makes a living doing that. I'm going to business school. And she's like, all right, but I don't know why. Yeah. You know, and then you do all the things. And I spent 12 years in corporate and I was just like, oh, this does not fit. This is not me. This isn't who I am. So I had the gumption to break free 8 years ago, and the rest is history.
Congratulations. You know, I started out in the aerospace industry in Arizona and saw the same things. It's like, the, you know, some of the stuff just wasn't right in how people treated people, especially guys, you know, that would beat people up because they wouldn't get what they wanted. And this was a kind of a traditional militaristic command and control kind of activity that when you're working with people who are really the most important element of any process, you've got to treat them well in order to really get what you need, which means being humble, having that humility and expressiveness, and being able to say, you know, what you're doing doesn't feel right to me, and I'd appreciate it if you'd stop.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Finding ways to break the cycle, you know, because if you don't say anything in those moments when people are saying icky things, then it's just going to perpetuate it.
And oftentimes does. Now, how did you experience that as you grew older and you know, having that 8-year-old awakening, right? Of just the recognition that that doesn't feel right. Okay. That's spot on. And you're paying attention at that point, right? And it wasn't something that you just imagined or constructed in your mind. You just acknowledged how it felt.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, now when I coach people on this, it's like keeping your radar up. You know, it's like putting up the antenna and the receptors and being more cognizant of what's happening. Mm-hmm. So a lot of things are just subconscious, or a lot of things are just ritualized in our society, right? Like, 'cause we don't have to think about it. Like, our brain can't take in all these stimuli, right? So we shortwire it. And that's why we all have some element of bias. And if we're not careful, it affects our behavior.
Sure.
Oh, so I think just watching out for it.
It's that old cognitive bias and logical fallacies, right, that kind of run our lives until we become aware of it. Now, if we could unpack, you mentioned the word, you know, this radar. How would you describe that? Mm. Because we often, you know, we talk about these things, semantics are one thing, but the deep intrinsic understanding and awareness that goes along with that, when that's shared, that really makes the difference, because you've got something to compare your own experience to. So yeah. What's that like for you? How would you unpack that?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like just watching out for things that might not feel good, that might be othering to somebody, that might make somebody feel uncomfortable. And a lot of these things are well-intentioned. You know, one mm-hmm. of the examples I use often is just language. How to use better inclusive language. People say harmful things and they don't even know they're doing it, right? Like the word guys, for example, and I get a lot of pushback on this one, but it is a term rooted in patriarchy that was purely used to describe groups of men, right, when women couldn't even enter social circles. So the history of the word has not been good.
Guys and fellow man.
Yes. Right? And we gender so much of our language.
Yeah.
Right. And I find myself that the biggest problem I have with this is my daughter and her group of friends who are all girls calling them guys because they're so used to saying, hey, guys.
Dude. Right.
Right. And I try to, I catch myself and I'm like, hey, y'all. And they're like, what? Like, they look at me funny. Like, why are you talking like that? You're not from the South. Yeah. Or hi, friends. And they're like, I'm Jade's friend.
Well, there is an Indiana or a Midwestern draw along with that. Hey, y'all.
Right? Yeah. Oh yeah. You get it. Southern Indiana. It changes in the hills. But, you know, I think just watching out for language like that. Another one that's hard for me is crazy. You know, if you say that around somebody that has a mental illness or is struggling with mental health, that can be very othering to them. That can make them feel like you think they're crazy. Right. And I think one of the things you can do for your radar is just watch out for non-inclusive language and just using an opportunity to jump in and correct. I corrected a family member last weekend, a word I'm not going to repeat that they should know better and not say, but it's just, they were saying it continuously too. It's like, all right, I'm going to jump in here. And all I said was like, hey.
Oh, and a lot of it's unaware.
No, exactly. And I was like, hey, I know I used to say that too. And here's what I've learned is a problem with it. Here's a different word that might not be so jarring for, you know, people mm-hmm. that have, you know, again, a mental health condition. And they were like, I didn't know. Like, thanks for sharing that with me.
Now, let me ask a question about again, back to the radar, right? And you're looking for these things. Now, I want to clarify that this isn't, or maybe let me ask the question. Is this a peering into where you're highly sensitive to, or is it something that is kind of sitting in the observation place in your mind that as you're proceeding with daily activity, when those things happen, that it comes up? Because there's a big difference between the two.
Yeah, I think it's probably the latter. I mean, it's kind of hanging, you're hanging out back there looking for things. And if you see something or say something where someone could have done better, or you yourself, you know, catching yourself, a lot of times we're slow to process these things. Our brains, thank you for me, right? Like the word guys and crazy fly out of my mouth way too much. And I'll catch myself, right? And then I'm like, oh, shoot, I didn't mean it. But here's what I actually meant to say. So I think it's something, it's kind of working in our operating system in the back.
Yeah, that, it's self-awareness to the extreme of being able to monitor your pre-thinking. Right? And that sounds kind of strange, but yet we can.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, okay, I feel this coming up. It's like that radar, right?
Yeah. You're
beginning to sense something. Now, how do I handle this?
Yeah. Exactly. And right. Sometimes it takes you some time to process it. You know, one of the terms we use in the diversity world is called microaggression. So this is a behavior aligned with bias that's problematic. So, you know, some of these words are slighter examples, but there's more overt forms of microaggressions or non-inclusive behaviors. And oftentimes there's a delay. So I've been privy to this before where someone said something and was like, oh shoot, they shouldn't have said that. And then like in the moment, I'm like, I don't know what to say. There's a group of us and I don't know how they're, if they're going to get defensive or what's going to happen. So
right.
I'll actually wait and circle back and be like, hey, when you said this earlier, I just want you to know the perception could be this, you know, some might consider that a microaggression. And but I would just be
less confrontational than had you brought it up in the moment, right? Yeah. Because the first thing that happens normally in conversations like that is the person will become defensive and not listen.
Shame and blame kicks in. And those are not,
where did that come from?
Right. Well, and like when anyone feels defensive or feels ashamed, when you trigger that emotion, you're right. They're not in a place of learning. And that's what you really want, right? You don't want to hurt somebody's feelings for no reason. You want them to change their behavior so they don't do it again. So
I don't think we ever intend to hurt somebody's feelings, although that happens when we're reaction, right? Maybe that the reactionary place, oh, you hurt me, now I'm going to hurt you to show you that you just hurt me. You know, that's kind of like killing people to show that killing people's not right.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make sense, right? And yet we do it.
Yeah, exactly. War is real. I mean, I think knowing it's not a competition, there's no winner. You know, one concept we talk about a lot, or I talk about a lot, is it's not a zero-sum game. So it's not I lose, you win. Oftentimes when we work together is what I call allies, you know, together mm-hmm. on each other's side, we're stronger together. Like it's not my pie slice versus your pie slice, so the pie gets bigger. There's right. more pie for everybody.
Right.
And there's tons of
you win, I win, and collectively we win because our relationship grows and it takes on a new form.
Yeah, exactly. But we live in a society where we're kind of conditioned to be competitive. You know, that scarcity mindset is very prevalent. And so you almost have to fight not only your brain's natural wiring for bias, mm-hmm. but also these mindsets in our culture that are very well baked. And so you're kind of swimming against the current when you practice some of these things. It's not as easy in practice as people think. It's harder. And it takes a toll too on your mental health. Like we know the rate of burnout in folks that do diversity work, it's very high.
Special ed's the same way. I taught, well, now it's called exceptional student programs because it got out of the special kind of.
Yeah. And I think
there's another connotation. Oh, that's so special.
Yeah, special needs isn't something we say anymore, right?
Yeah, and yet that's true. When you give your heart and soul to something that you're passionate about, even though you may not be trained to do so, I wasn't trained. I had an MBA, and I got my secondary teaching cert, and an assistant principal thought I would be a great special ed teacher, and they needed one. So he asked me to get an emergency cert, which I did. Loved it. Had a blast with the kids. Wasn't too well liked by the department heads that in the schools that I worked in because of that. And I never, you know, I eventually got that because I was an example of what maybe they had hoped to be and had lost it in the process of the burnout. And here I was kind of fresh, full of vigor and, you know, just want to have fun, do the right things and treat the kids like people.
Yeah, I think there's some envy there where when people, you know, just kind of get beat down by the system over the years and do exhausting work, you see someone fresh come in. It's like, well, I wish I remember being like that too. Like there's the concept that happens in the diversity world that's kind of like that is this tug of war bias that we have, especially when there's just one person. So if there's just one woman, one person of color, one person with a disability, in a group, you know, there's this idea, like there's only enough room for one of us. So if someone else joins the group of that identity, there can be infighting. And this is created often is orchestrated again by society. This is not natural because, you know, I first started doing this work. People are like, well, women need to be better allies to women. I was like, all right, there's nothing innately in our biology that women are against women. We are taught that. In our culture.
Right, right. The when you look at history and how cultures and tribes, and especially in the tribal environments, everybody supported each other. They all took part in raising the village, not just the kids, each other. Respect for the elders, respect for the, you know, the wise women.
Yeah.
Especially. And in the indigenous cultures, they were matriarchal. Mm-hmm. And yet we still, and from a historical perspective, paint them as patriarchal.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And other problematic things like savages and, you know, other words right. that are used, like primitive.
It's so ridiculous. And it's all a facade that, that some, now how, okay, so back to the process here. As you're going through this facadical experience, how did you begin to recognize others who were also on the same or similar wavelength as you? Because that's part of the process too. It's like we think we're individual or that we're in solitude because we tend to be so different than the group.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to find your allies. You got to find other people that are on the same page as you that think similarly to you and different than you. I mean, I think we live, it's one of the big problems we have right now is the polarization. You know, you're this, you're good, you're bad, you're this party, you're that party. You know, it's not talking to each other like we used to be able to. It's unfortunate, but finding people that are on your wavelength. And I think just put out the vibe, you know, like well, the language thing matters. You know, when someone shares their pronouns, for example, I know right away it's somebody I can get along with. Like I just, I know like they're on the same page as me. So that's one great signal. I think you can put out in the universe, share your pronouns.
But I also go beyond that. I mean, you see what I have instead
of. Yeah, I've never seen those before. I am and we are.
I'm a paradigm buster, right? Because I am and we are at the core, right? So why not start there? Why not start with how we are the same? That's what we do with the Live and Let Live movement, which I feel so honored and responsible in now as executive director, in that it's really simple. You know, we've got two rules. Don't be an aggressor. Be a good human.
It should be that simple, right? Be
a good It is. And that's what we forget.
Mm-hmm.
It's peeling those layers back to get to that simpleness. And then we realize, oh, all these other layers of the onion are constructs as opposed to what's natural.
Yeah. Yeah. I take it a step further. One mantra I've borrowed, I believe it was in the book, Me and White Supremacy. So heavy read, but she talks about being a good ancestor.
Yes.
And I love that because it's like, okay, not only am I going to be a good human, but I want to make sure, I mean, I've got kiddos and I care about human beings and our livelihood on this planet. And I want to make sure that I left an impact with my life, you know, for other people and for future generations. And so when things get hard, because they do, I mean, being a good human, it sounds easy, but it's easy to throw a temper tantrum.
Well, yeah. And we've got all kinds, should we... And shitting on yourself isn't good. Should we take that on and begin to point fingers and things like that? You know, you got three coming up or six, depending, coming back at you. And we take those opportunities to fall out of alignment with ourselves. You know, I mentioned that I was born in Indianapolis. I was born an orphan. I was given up at birth. Could have really made for a life of victimization, right? And I had enough experiences through my life where I could have taken that route too. However, I chose to see the greater family instead. I don't know strangers. I can walk up and talk to anybody about anything pretty much. And that in itself is really surprising out in public because people don't know quite how to take me, and yet everybody has fun in the process.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's beautiful. I mean, to honor your lived experiences, it's another thing I like to talk about. It's like everyone has their own set of lived experiences that they bring to conversations. You know, your upbringing then was very different than mine, even though you could say, oh, we both grew up in like the Midwest. I mean, you know, talking about how you came to be with your family and you were in a more rural setting than I was in a more urban setting. There's just so many nuances and things that affect us. Mm-hmm. And a lot of things are outside of our control, right? You didn't choose where you're born to and who you're born to. No one does.
Well, that could be a different conversation from another realm of perspective.
Oh, too. Okay.
Right. There is that you choose. But if you consider that we are, this is one of the things I learned in my spiritual awakening as a teenager, that we're actually cosmic consciousness condensed into form. Mm-hmm. And unaware of that. But from that point of light that we are, that's where our awareness grows from. And we make the choices. They're not necessarily beliefs. They're choices we make of how to behave. And the results that we get from that determine our next choice.
That's interesting. Right? Yeah.
I see, belief systems as just a bunch of BS that we're not willing to take on ourselves to choose how we co-create our reality.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. There's a lot of choices that we make. I mean, I think about my 2-year-old, I'm like, I mean, how many choices does she get to make? You know, and usually dangerous choices. So it is.
And you need to allow a certain amount of that danger for them to experience in order to learn on their own. You tell them not to do something, what do they hear? They don't hear the don't, right? They hear the something, and so they go do it.
Exactly. Exactly. And I'll never forget with my oldest, she got on her little bike and you just know, like, she wanted to ride it down the hill. And you just know at like 3 years old, like, this is not gonna go well.
Yeah.
But exactly what you said. It's like, I gotta let her fall and make her own choices so that she learns. And guess what? She fell and I watched and it was terrible. Mm-hmm. I mean, she just got a scratch, like a bump on her knee, but she never did it again.
Right. And it's those minor events, you don't want to throw them in a place where their actual danger exists. That's just, some do.
I think that might be called child abuse.
yeah, absolutely. And yet we all, this is how we grow. We see things and we often deem them as mistakes or failures or things. And to me, that's also prescriptive. They aren't. Mm-hmm. It's just part of life. Why do we have to judge ourselves so harshly?
Yeah.
And then turn that into self-deprecation. What do you see, speaking of that, what do you see in diversity, equity, and inclusion as evidence of that self-deprecation happening to those who are aggressed upon?
The retaliation, like, oh, well, someone said I wasn't inclusive, or someone said I did something bad, so I'm gonna, throw an adult temper tantrum, do something back. Yeah, it happens. And I hear countless stories. I mean, I was doing a live workshop not too long ago, a couple weeks ago, and the number one question I do an Ask Me Anything anonymous poll, and people ask some doozies. Mm. And the one I got asked by 3 different people of the 10 people that asked a question was, what do I do for white men that are afraid? What do I do? How do I have this conversation with the guy that isn't inclusive? And it's like, we're so worried about offending the dominant group with this conversation that then we end up watering it down or placating these topics or making excuses like, well, he's a good guy, he didn't mean it, And so I think this fear factor that you're going to get the backlash prevents us from having the very conversation that we need to have. And so I,
How would you handle that? How do you think it's necessary to bring that up on the fly in the moment in a way? And I'm sure you have practice at this too, right? So don't try this at home.
Do try, but there might
be something. Or do try, you knew what I meant. How would you address that? Because it's true, right? A lot of white men are scared. Yeah. They're scared of being confronted. And so they're reactionary. They shut down. They become projectiles, whether it's verbal or otherwise, depending. So how does that conversation evolve in a way that moves things forward? Because there is this psychological safety and intellectual humility that becomes involved.
Yep.
How do you bring that out?
Yeah.
Recommend bringing that out.
Yeah. Psychological safety is really interesting. Listeners, if you're not familiar with the term, I call it like feeling safe doing hard things, saying hard things, you know, uncomfortable things, challenging. And Google has done tons of research to show like that's the number one factor in a high performing team is they have psychological safety. So this isn't like foo-foo stuff. This is real, like human stuff.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't stop in the workplace. Like we're all humans in all spheres of our lives. Can't be a widget or a robot.
I love what T. Harv Eker said years ago. What you do anywhere, you do everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. There's no on and off switch, right? Like I don't leave this office being a jerk. But we've compartmentalized our lives until obviously I think we've really broken a lot of that with COVID. But
we have the same behaviors throughout it all.
Yeah, yeah, we never stop being
subtle, but they're still there.
Well, and what's interesting for marginalized folks, and I'll get to your question, is you know, for folks that don't see themselves reflected in organizations, often they have to cover, you know, kind of pretend to be a different version of them in the workplace. They're doing a lot of code switching to, mm-hmm. you know, ramp up elements about themselves to fit.
And do you think the DISC assessments have a lot to do with that? Because they break it up into natural and adaptive styles, right?
So yeah, that's true.
Reinforce that.
Yeah, that's a good example. I love DISC and use it a lot as a tool because that's a form of diversity. How we're wired, you know, how our personalities, how our perspectives that we bring naturally, like you said, and then the ones we flex because we've learned to flex them or we have to flex them for our role. So we often require people that are not the dominant group to flex a lot more. And that just is emotionally taxing day in and day out. And again, that's why you see higher turnover rates, et cetera. But to answer your question about psychological safety.
Do you think that's because attachment to outcome?
Maybe. I mean, it depends on how people are wired, right? Like the example I use is like Caterpillar was my first job out of college. And, you know, here I am a 23-year-old blonde white woman in a union environment managing people on third shift. Yeah, it was rough. That was tough. And, you know, what did I do? I wore men's clothing. Like I dressed like the guys because I wanted to be taken seriously and they didn't even make jackets or boots in women's sizes anyway. So I had to, but, you know, you don't wear jewelry. You don't wear makeup. You tie your hair back. You try to look as masculine as you can. And I would like talk about sports with them or like more masculine oriented subjects because I wanted to be one of them.
Right.
And, you know, having to do all that was pretty tiring. And you just don't realize it. Like that first month after I left, I was just like, oh my gosh, I can be me again. I had no idea the shenanigans I was going through on a daily basis. It was just like autopilot.
Right. Now, I kind of got on autopilot and continue asking questions. I didn't give you a chance to answer one. So
yeah, back to you said like psychological safety with somebody that maybe isn't so inclusive or doesn't get it. And, you know, going back to that question, I think stories are really powerful. So here's the thing. You can't want somebody to change for them. They have to decide. Mm-hmm. And so it's something empathy provoking. There's a ton of research on this. Humans remember stories much more than facts and figures. So when I go in with the business case, like you need to care about this because XYZ results, like that hasn't been effective. You're usually met with resistance, or even if people buy into that, that's a very like rational thought process. Human beings are more wired for emotion, and our limbic system is really making decisions. We just justify it with that prefrontal cortex. So anyway, I think telling a story, I encourage people, if you feel comfortable, and this requires a bit of vulnerability. So if you don't have a healthy amount of trust, you know, think about how comfortable you could be with it, but share a story that you've experienced something or that somebody you know experienced something. And usually that empathetic bridge creates a connection. And oftentimes people mirror and match. They will join that conversation and be like, oh my gosh, I had no idea that was a thing. Here's something that happened to me too, or here's something that I heard, right, or here's something I saw. The conversation
opens the door.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just a conversation starter. And I caution people, if you don't feel comfortable doing that, don't put yourself in a dangerous situation. That's why psychological safety is important. That can be physical a vehicle safety to do it. Too. Yeah, physically. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. If you're with a tormentor, you know, somebody that you've had really rough experiences with, you're probably not going to start there. And that's when you might have to, you know, look up and around. And I like to find with somebody that has problematic behavior, who do they trust and respect? Is that somebody that could be my ally, you know, to help the influence the
absolutely
person?
Widen the circle, right? Yeah. We think it's the one-on-one and it's a village.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be you. And especially if you've been marginalized, especially if you've had bad experiences, you don't want to re-traumatize yourself. So you really have to be protective of your energy. Mm-hmm. You know, when I go into a hard conversation, you know, there's a armor removal process that takes some time, right? You know, Brene Brown says it's like, you know, open heart.
I have a, it was one of my first attempts to share my process. This was back 1991. I gave a presentation to a group, and the presenter, the MC actually called it the stripper. And so it's called Zen's Mystic Moments. And it's actually on YouTube. It's a 24-minute and 24-second video about me using a three-piece suit as a live metaphor for exactly what you're talking about, taking off the coat of armor, divesting ourselves, untying the knots, giving the shirt off our backs, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And no script, right? This is how it was presented to me through the inner sensory array. The delivery process, the information that arrived, here's what you need to do. And so without question, I went and did it, and it worked out just fine. And there's an artifact. But and you're talking about stories, the oral traditions. I hear a lot of Native American indigenous philosophy mm-hmm. in this, because they're oral traditions, right? They very rarely wrote things down. It was all passed along. Yeah. I'm reminded of another gentleman, one of the first interviews I had on my first show back in the 90s, and Mixed Blood Cherokee. And he says that, you know, there's this prophecy that women will cut their hair, put on war paint, dress for war, and go to battle with the men. Essentially, he said it in a much more eloquent way, but this is what you're talking about, what you had to do.
Yeah. Right?
Dressed like a man, looked like a man, went in and to do battle in a man's world. And that's part of the initial identification of this transitory and transformational period.
Yeah, it is. I mean, recognizing the armor that some people have to wear more so than others and empathizing with that. I feel for folks because there's a lot of areas of privilege that I have. You know, I'm white, I'm straight, I identify as cisgender. For the most part, I'm welcomed in most spaces. I can be very mobile. I can go to all sorts of different communities and be welcomed in those communities. That's just simply not the case for a lot of people of color, for people that have a disability, for folks in the LGBTQ plus community. Like, and so I take that as like, that's a way I can be helpful towards others. Like, how do I leverage those natural privileges for good? Right. How do I use it to help others? Because it doesn't make me a bad person. It doesn't mean I didn't earn, you know, the things that I have, but it does mean that it wasn't about my race, the hardship I had. It wasn't about, you know, sometimes it might have been about my gender identity. That's one element, right? I don't quite have privilege necessarily, but being a white woman in the United States isn't probably the worst case scenario for a human on the planet. So
you
got to think it was like, okay, things could definitely be worse, and other people have, you know, situations and hardships that are just beyond what I've lived.
Right. And you mentioned something that I thought is really important, and that's the viewpoints that others have, whether you're, you know, in other groups, you're visiting, you're part of a community, whatever. And I had some personal experience that I mentioned being in the aerospace industry. I got divorced, left the industry. And my first job after that was working with developmentally disabled adults. Mm. And myself and a female partner would take a group out into the community to do day programming, is what it was called, and basically teach them community living skills, right? Or show them. And they were challenged. And as we were in public places, the looks, the variety, diversity of the looks and impressions that you could see on people's faces and body language, and, you know, some would come closer, some would distance themselves immediately. And I was always just playful and engaging with the clients because I could.
Yeah.
And the clients responded much better that way because they weren't being managed. They were being played with.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's interesting to pay attention to people's responses, right? And what creates, one of the concepts we talk about are like windows and mirrors. So it's important to see yourself reflected in a group, right? As a mirror, but you also want a window into other perspectives and other, you know, elements of difference. And this becomes really important. You know, one of the things I'm really passionate about is with kids, making sure they have those windows and mirrors. And most children's books, I mean, I was horrified when I looked at my bookshelf. It was all animals and white kids, you know, and, right, and very stereotypical, quote unquote, traditional families. You know, there was not a lot of diversity on my bookshelf. And I was like, oh dear, we got to get better at this. And there's data on that supports there's more characters in kids' books that are animals than all kids of color represented. It's like, that's a problem. And that's still a problem in 2022, believe it or not.
And that's, I do believe, largely because of the continued patriarchal rule. You know, most of the media systems are owned by a very few white men. Mm-hmm. Most of the printing companies, textbooks and things like that, same thing. And marginalized information. And as we've learned from historical perspectives, the history is written by the victors, not the vanquished. And it takes eons, if ever, where the truth actually comes out about the events. And
I know.
So we like to, rather than go down that path, let's go back to where...
History books are interesting, though, I will say. I mean, it's still worth a fight there. But yeah, I mean, we have to do our own research on history. It's exactly. You're not going to find it in your textbook growing up.
You know, I had a bumper sticker for a while. Critical thinking, the nation's other deficit.
Yeah.
And I think that's true. We, even with that, when you began... Let's look at your early adulthood, how that provided those windows and mirrors to you, and how that might be useful to compare lives that others are leading now, regardless of gender or color. How might they see things differently in their own lives in order to provide a positive impact for themselves and others?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think young people are so important to this conversation. Not that we don't want to engage all generations and all ages. It's just, as you grow older, that hardwiring just gets, you know, more and more cemented. And, you know, when I reflect on my youth and the perspective I had, and the perspective my 8-year-old has, she'll say things like, racism doesn't make sense, Mom. You know, like, why would you treat somebody like that? Like, that doesn't make sense. And when we talked about slavery, because she hasn't learned about slavery yet in school. And when she does, you know, be very whitewashed to our point about books.
Sure.
But she goes, Mom, it's just not fair not to pay people for their work. You know, I find myself in a different mental place. Like, it's not that simple for me. It's like, this is wrong. This is horrible. Like, why didn't people stop this? You know, I go to another emotional place, but she's just like, yeah, it's just wrong. That doesn't make sense to me. Like, who signed up for that? You know, why did we let that? And it's just, I think engaging young people in the conversation is just going to be so important. And, you know, when you think about Gen Z and this next generation, that's, you know, going to be coming into the workforce and just our next generation of leaders, they have a very inclusive mindset. You know, they see it as a non-negotiable, whereas previous generations, like my generation, Gen X and millennials, we kind of were like, yeah, it's a nice to have, but oh, those boomers said no. So I guess we'll just take it, you know? And so we can't keep kicking the can to younger people to lead the way. I think they need tools, they need information, but the more we actively talk about these things, and they are, I mean, they're seeing what's happening in the Middle East, you know, right now, they're seeing what's happening right in Ukraine, you know, they're privy to global issues in a way that I don't think previous generations were. So they know.
Absolutely. We have the internet, right? Information's everywhere. However, I would offer it's still marginalized to a great degree in protection of those who are managing the agenda.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a problem.
And we don't see that.
It's a problem that social media is controlled by mostly white men. I mean, that's a big problem because that's a huge source of our content. And the fact that a billionaire could try to buy Twitter, you know, is just nuts to me. Like,
well,
that
is... like growing up for me, you know, we were taught Russia is our enemy.
Yeah.
Right. And we're still taught.
Still teaching that. Yeah. Oh yeah. 100%.
Right. And even with what's happening right now, there's no talk of the couple of decades of history in the Ukraine of encroachment that's been happening. Mm-hmm. And none of that's coming to light. And a lot of that I was unaware of. I married a woman, I met my twin flame in 2016. She's from St. Petersburg, Russia.
Wow.
And she's a college trained, conservatory trained, I would say, pianist and teacher.
Wow.
And her understanding, the knowledge base that she has of Russian history is phenomenal. And so we have all these conversations.
Oh, I'd love to be at your dinner table. That's got to be interesting.
Oh, man, it just brightened my world because there were things that, you know, like you said, things just didn't feel right. No, these are people too. Right.
Yeah.
And people really baseline, they just want to be peaceful.
Yeah. 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 I think it's one thing to know that there are problematic people and especially problematic leaders, but not all people are bad. You know, to say Russia's our enemy and all Russians are bad. I mean, these are people, like you said, these are people that might disagree or might not have any choices.
Well, and then the cognitive bias comes in, right? Because we're biased from what we know and what we're told. And so we're not able to move beyond that and simply step back and say, okay, let's try and peel back the layers to just get to the basic facts of events and what happened and look at that first rather than succumb to all the emotional projections that we're getting.
Yeah.
Something happened with the narrative from COVID, right? Where you know, you're supposed to be afraid of each other, wear a mask, hide.
Mm-hmm. Right. And especially Asian Americans took the brunt of so much hate in that time period as well. So it's always, you know, I always.
Just as the Islamics and Middle Easterners took, you know, after the 9/11.
Yep.
Totally.
History repeats itself.
Right. Just different patterns, right? Chaos, speaking of patterns, chaos is to me, is an evolution of understanding of the patterns in it. We don't understand to begin with, but everything in the universe is mathematically and scientifically intricately woven, so intricately that we cannot fathom just how much so yet.
Yeah, yeah. What
we are discovering.
It's hard to see what you just see as your normal every day, right? It's hard to see like it's what the frog in the water or
the frog in the boiling water.
Yeah. You don't notice it because it's just your environment. You just take it for granted.
Instead of questioning it. and questioning how we can be better in it. Now, how do you do that? How do you draw out that educate, right? Which is the draw out. How do you draw out that information from people that you work with and present to?
I mean, it helping people see what they haven't seen, you know, and I often say, then they can't unsee it. Mm-hmm. But getting people to see things they haven't experienced is probably one of my biggest problems, right? So my life's work, you know, is really about engaging allies in the conversation. Well, who can be the best allies? People with power and privilege, aka white, straight, you know, cisgender men. Do you find that
a better visceral experience or intellectual one or a combination of both?
If
there's a missing element, what's impactful? You know, it would seem that the visceral would be the best, right? Because you get it in your entire, it's the experience, not the thought experiment.
It's hard to do that though. Like you can't walk around, if you're a white person, you can't walk around in black or brown skin. Like, and you shouldn't, right? So you can't necessarily get that visceral, like personal experience. Oftentimes you have to do it by proxy to someone else that you care about. Mm-hmm. And when you hear a story from somebody of color or somebody of a different gender identity, and they tell you like this actually happened to me, I think that's when the visceral can kick in. But we know that exposure is not always the solution. There's tons of white people that grow up in neighborhoods of color and have deeply racist beliefs because of things they experienced. So it's not just an exposure problem. It's a mindset problem too. And so it has to be, I think exposure helps speed up the curve, but at some point somebody has to be willing to say, I don't know about this. I don't understand this. This isn't my lived experiences. Therefore, I have to be vulnerable and open and empathetic.
Ooh, there's the big word, right? You got to be vulnerable. No.
Men not to be, right? That's not part of masculinity.
That's the opposite of true strength, though, right? And you and I both know that, and many who are listening, I'm sure, do too. However, how do we share that? How do we encourage others to feel that psychological safety and vulnerability?
Yeah, I mean, this is another one. Brené Brown, if you haven't seen her TED Talk, like I always recommend that one on vulnerability. But she, you know, she and others, you know, one of the things that I've found with vulnerability is if you can model it, right? And I think we're modeling that right now in this conversation. It gives people the permission, the psychological safety to join in. So I always think go first, right? Put yourself out there first, especially if it's uncomfortable. Vulnerability cannot be predicted. It can't be planned for it to be truly vulnerable.
But you can example it.
Yeah, you can model it. And then I would say also if you're struggling with motivation to do that with somebody, especially somebody that maybe you don't want to, is think about the people you care about most in your life. I guarantee. You know, I just exercise with people. Tell me about like the top five people in your life that you trust, that you care about, that you want, you choose to spend time with. And always it's openness, it's honesty, it's I can tell them anything. It's like I can be my full self with them. Like, what is that all saying? Vulnerability, right? So you feel the safest, you feel most connected to who you are as a human when you're being vulnerable. So try doing it. And people are so afraid that people are going to attack them. You know, one of the most vulnerable things they have to do for a living is ask for feedback. And it's always cringy. You know, I always get a little sweaty. I'm always afraid someone's going to rip me apart and tell me how terrible I am. That has rarely happened. Like maybe twice that has happened of the hundreds of times I've done it. Some of it's warranted. So you got to be ready for that if you ask the question.
Totally relate. Did the same thing when I was in I was doing partnering workshops for building road and bridge construction projects all over the country. And you want to talk about tough nuts, right? The construction engineers and safety guys and contractors and man, they can be really tough. I don't want to say cruel because they still tell you, they don't mince words, but they still will let you know when you missed something, right?
Yeah.
So we got that after survey or that after presentation survey of, okay, how did I do?
Like, yes. Yeah,
the questions and then you get them back and you go, okay, do I want to look at this or not?
Right.
And yet you have to, because that's how you grow.
Yeah. Yeah, and those probably aren't the most psychologically safe work environments.
Yeah, they didn't used to be. That's what partnering has done. You know, here in Arizona, when it was instituted in 1990, there were $19 million in litigation fees with the state. And so in 91, they instituted the partnering process. In 92, it had dropped to less than a million.
Yeah. So there's real detrimental effects of that kind of toxic workplace behavior. It costs money. And there's really cool research that shows with like the great resignation or quiet quitting, whatever people are trending on right now.
Right.
So much of it's attributed to toxic, non-inclusive workplaces. That's why people are really leaving. Like I'm sick.
It's always been known. You don't leave because you don't like the work. You leave because you don't like your boss.
Exactly. And your manager is a huge perception of the culture. So if they're getting talked down to, you're getting rude feedback, getting asked to work all hours of the day, you know, you're probably not going to stay in those places. Where I think pre-pandemic, we were.
But how do you speak up in that? Let's say you love the work and you want to stay. How do you speak up in order to invite and engage the kind of behavior towards yourself that you'll accept?
I mean, two thoughts. One is just making sure you've emphasized your boundaries. I mean, I think a lot of people do. I have a dear friend that she's like, I block my calendar when I'm taking time off and people will schedule over it. You know, they just like ignore her boundaries. Like you have to really reinforce that. And people don't like that, especially when you haven't reinforced your boundaries before. So being crystal clear on your boundaries with people, reinforce them. And then the other thing I would say is, you know, be ready to have a hard conversation with somebody. If you're not getting treated the way you want to, you know, have those examples to show people.
And get over your fear of your loss of job.
Yeah, exactly.
If you're going to lose your job over it, it wouldn't worth having to begin with.
No. And I think we humans overvalue loss, right? Loss aversion is very real. We're afraid of losing a job. It's good paying. I have good benefits. You know, it's not that bad. You know, the stories we tell ourselves.
But how do we flip it to finding?
Exactly. We found that with the great resignation, though. People are like, well, shoot, I could find something better somewhere else. And I don't need, there's no incentive to really stay at a company for decades anymore either. You don't get the Rolex, you don't get the pension. So why stay?
My dad told me early on, he was kind of a little irritated because they didn't go the corporate route initially. He was a GM guy, worked in Anderson 38 years, right? Night shift. And he always said to me, find a good company, retire. Right. And I'm like, no, that just doesn't work. And, you know, even after the aerospace incident, right, I said, tried it your way. Didn't work. Put my best foot forward in everything that I did. And I know that unequivocally because I can look at myself in the mirror and know it. Right. Speaking of mirrors. And yet it didn't work. I'm like, okay, tried that, didn't work. What's next? And just
I think that's a great question to ask yourself. What is next? What do I want? What do I really want? And dig into that. It's a good mirror introspective question. And if you start there and you're like, okay, how many of those things are happening currently in my life? Like, and there's a disconnect, like maybe that's why you're not happy. You know, maybe that's why, you know, for me, it was like Monday morning, sick feeling in my stomach, having to go to work. And, you know, if you do that week after week, and I remember comparing notes with my friends and they're like, what? Like, I don't feel sick going to work on Monday. I kind of like going to work on Monday. I'm like, what? Right. How'd you lie about that?
And then there are those who, because of that and because of the inner constrictions, I'll say that it causes energetically dis-ease happens. And it could be it could be relatively simple, like an ulcer, or it could be catastrophic, like a cancer.
Yeah. Yeah. Heart attacks. I mean, we know stress. It's a huge impact on our health and our outcomes. And, you know, I was reading about Denmark recently as a country and why they're continuously ranked one of the happiest countries. And it's because they value life over work. Like it's actually frowned upon to work late because it's your boss will likely talk to you about being inefficient. Like you need to work your hours, get your work done during your hours. Not, you know, here in the States is the exact opposite. Like, oh yeah, you worked late and responded to that email at midnight. Like, great job. It's right. Like, that's not healthy.
unless that's all you're doing, right? Or that, or your life is and work is so wrapped together, and that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, you do you. I mean, if that's when you do your best work, that's a different conversation. But if you're always on for fear of someone getting mad at you or something, then that's a different story.
Oh yeah, and your life is going to be full of stress. Your body's going to be racked with pain. You're going to have, you know, all the symptoms, the headaches, the bad relationships, those kinds of, you know, your kids aren't going to want to be around you, right? That's a good indicator, right? If you're not able to be with your kids, how can you be with somebody else?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. The people that you care about most, if they start to distance themselves from you, like, there's probably something you need to do, right? There's probably some healing you need to do yourself, so that you can be there for others.
And yet we don't think about that because we've got nobody, you know, kids can't say, hey, mom, hey, dad, you know, you're being an asshole.
Right.
Right. When are you going to stop?
It's like the frog in water again, right? You don't see how painful it is until you hop out and you're like, ooh, it's much better out here.
Right. Right. And I hope you weren't offended by that, but, it's so important that how would you, in the throes of this change, what's the best kind of advice that you could offer from your experience to help others open that door to diversity, equity, and inclusion and themselves?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest piece of advice I give folks is, If you're interested in step one or a baby step, you're like, whoa, this is like heavy stuff. I don't know how comfortable I feel talking about this stuff. Like, I
still. Therein is the old adage, baby steps, Bob.
Yeah.
Not to be patriarchal.
Right. But one step at a time. Human behavior doesn't shift overnight. Centuries of inequality will not be solved in our lifetime, unfortunately. But what can you do? What's one thing you can do? And one tangible thing that I always recommend, this strategy, and Ally shared this strategy with me when I first started my business, is diversify your network. You know, who are you spending time with? If you're like most people, myself included, it's people like me, right? Whether that's gender, race, you know, ethnicity, culture, background, age, caregiving status. There's so many elements that we gravitate towards people like us, and that's not where we learn. That's not where we grow. And that exposure piece helps accelerate the inclusion piece of the journey. Mm-hmm. And so I would just say, listeners, if you don't know what to do, open up your social media, preferred social media channel, start following people that are different than you. I mean, you don't have to, like, you know, go around your neighborhood and find different people and knock on their door, but, you know, get creative. Yeah. But, you know, with me, I'm very sensitive to this. So when I'm walking around my neighborhood and I see a person of color, I see somebody of a different ethnicity, I'm really like wanting them to feel welcome here because it's a very white dominated community. I'm like, hi, how are you? You know, do I do that with white people? Probably not. Cause like, there's a lot of us here. They already feel welcome.
I did that.
Not that I'm discriminating.
Too. You know, Alec was no color except in the, picking season, and then we'd have Mexican migrant workers.
Yeah.
And so those were the guys that I was taking Spanish at the time, so I'd connect with them and have more fun with the migrant workers that were in school and I would with people that I grew up with, right? Just because they were different. I was curious.
Yeah.
I didn't see them as being a threat. I saw them as being an opportunity to get to know more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really all we are. It is an opportunity to get to know more about ourselves and about others.
Yeah. And once you know, right, once you see that the world is different for different people, then you can't unsee it. And then it starts to unlock a different set of behaviors that can be more helpful to other people. So, you know, just be careful who you're spending time with. The first time I did that exercise, I was like, oh gosh, white woman, you know, straight moms, business owners. It was like all me. And I was like, oh, that's like looking hard in the mirror. And not that I'm perfect at this. I still have a lot of work to do, but my social feed is very different now than it was 8 years ago when I started doing this work. My friend circle is very different than when I first started doing this work. But it's something I have to continuously work on. Because it's easy to fall back into our default mode. It's easy to go comfortable again.
Yeah, exactly. And it reminds me of a conversation I'm having on LinkedIn currently with a professor from Pakistan. And we're talking about humility and being able to disagree about things and learning from each other. And the practicing, right, exactly what we're talking about. And I called him a brother from another mother recently, and he was just very appreciative and honored by that, as I am too by him, because we're both being examples of how to do this, and hopefully others can see it as well and learn. We're not perfect, and you know we make mistakes. We're human beings. We're emotionally driven. We are going to be triggered. It's the ability to manage those triggers better. That's actually the essence of being a good human.
I agree. And what an unlikely friendship. I mean, how often do you see that modeled, you know, cross-cultural friendships, you know, people with different religious backgrounds, spiritual backgrounds, we kind of divide people up and we teach this. Whereas kids naturally are very, you know, inclusive and curious about differences. It's when we shush them. It's when we tell them it's not okay to see those things or talk about those things that they learn to be afraid of it.
Right. And we often think, you know, it's not the, and we're talking about friendships. We grew up in the early times in my life, probably early your life, the friendships were developed from spending time with each other. And now with the international flavor, the virtual flavor, that has been greatly truncated, where you don't need those copious amounts of time with each other's with each other in order to become friends. Right. Yeah. You have those truncated, direct, open, vulnerable conversations, and it takes much less time to really recognize and honor each other in the process and then grow from there. I find that's particularly relevant with the live and not live movement.
Yeah.
Why I'm having to consider all kinds of different cultures and belief systems and perceptions and indicators like that. That little chime that came in is, this is important that we are.
That's cool, Zen. Yeah, I think that's great. It's a good way to look at things.
Well, thank you. And I really appreciate the time that you've given, Julie, and look forward to many more.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And namaste and in la catch. Thanks for sticking with us for this episode of One World in a New World. I'm Zen Benefiel, your host, and I will see you next time.